Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We start with the lame duck session in Michigan. Republicans call it protection, Democrats are calling it a power grab. This week, the state legislature voted that small businesses would not have to provide paid sick time. And the minimum wage would still hit $12 an hour, but not until 2030. Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff says the changes will be good for business.
So I think it's really important that the employers can be confident that they can deliver these benefits to employees, and we thought this was important to do it this way.
Protesters are frustrated that an initiative that they wanted to vote on is now being changed, and quickly, by lawmakers that are not coming back next year. Susan Hendricks is from Grand Blanc.
This legislature is deciding things for Michigan without actually talking to any of its people.
That's just two of hundreds of bills passed by the GOP-controlled legislature in the past 2 weeks. Joining me now is Emily Lawler with MLive. Welcome to Current State.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's first talk about the minimum wage and paid sick time. Earlier this year, voters were supposed to vote on these. What happened to that?
Yeah, so the legislature, instead of sending them to the ballot, adopted the proposals themselves, which made them law. But they want to come back this same session and change the proposals that they adopted. So, you know, proponents of the original proposals say that the changes kind of gut the intent of the proposals. On the minimum wage one, they extended the timeline of the increase. So the $12-plus minimum wage was scheduled to go in 2022, wouldn't go in until 2030 under this proposal, which, you know, I guess kind of who knows what $12.05 an hour will look like in 2030 or what our cost of living will look like then. And then the paid sick time was meant to apply to virtually everybody working for most businesses. And this kind of brought it down to businesses with under or fewer than 50 employees wouldn't have to comply, wouldn't have to offer this same type of paid sick leave that's going to be required of larger companies.
What's been the reaction to all of this, and why did Republicans push to change these bills?
So Republicans were pretty open about the fact that they wanted to amend these even as far back as when they adopted them in September. So I don't think it was any huge surprise there. I think that they wanted to work with the business community a little bit more. When the business community was testifying in some committees, they talked about how they really hadn't been included in the original processes. So I think that the legislature wanted to kind of give them some input, see what was feasible for them, in addition to, you know, trying to accommodate some of the needs of the original proposal backers. But, you know, it's kind of one of those things where, you know, on the other side of the aisle, Democrats and people who really supported these are saying, well, wait a second, this isn't what voters would have passed.
Do we have any idea if Governor Snyder will sign these bills?
So I don't have a great idea. You know, his spokesperson, the governor kind of got involved in some discussions around it, I guess, at the tail end. His spokesperson made it seem like it was very open still on whether he would sign them or not. But I will say that Senate Majority Leader Meekhoff seems very confident that they are going to get signed. And, you know, he seemed to have that firsthand information. So I'm not sure what the disconnect is there.
Let's talk about animals now. Tell us about the bill to end local breed bans.
Yeah, we saw some committee action on that. And this has been one of those things that's kind of come up in the legislature over the last several sessions, really. And it's come up in both directions, really. Some people have talked about wanting to ban some kind of breeds. Specifically, pit bulls seem to be the ones that always come up in these types of discussions. And some communities have actually you know, enacted some restrictions on breeds. And this bill would just basically say that's not okay anymore. It's one of the preemption bills. So it would preempt local governments from being able to put that sort of breed-specific ban in place.
We are talking with MLive's Emily Lawler about the lame duck session of the Michigan legislature, passing bills left and right. We also know communities like Ann Arbor are sterilizing deer for population control. I understand now there's a bill to ban that.
Yeah, we got all the fun animal stuff going, don't yes. we? I mean, lame duck, I guess that's appropriate.
Right.
Yeah, so Ann Arbor has this program that's kind of a mixture of sterilization and then also mixing that with more traditional methods of culling. So they're doing this on kind of a research-type permit from the DNR at this point. And Tristan Cole, the sponsor of this legislation, these bills would kind of take that ability away, not let the DNR issue those types of research sterilization permits. And I think the idea is kind of to take a step back and look at the science on this. You know, they've had this research permit for a couple of years now, and I'm not really certain that there are any clear-cut results.
And then away from the animals, there's a measure to ban local governments from putting in tree ordinances.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a preemption theme going on here, I think we've seen. But this is based off a pretty specific circumstance in Canton Township, where two brothers who owned some commercial industrial property cut a lot of trees down and have made the argument that I guess they were planning to replace those trees with Christmas trees and make a Christmas tree farm. So I guess seasonally appropriate as well. But, you know, the sponsor of this legislation kind of sees this as a property rights issue, that they should be able to cut trees on their own property. But the township came in with a big fine. And so this would prevent this from happening anywhere in the state. And I think that it's met a lot of opposition from people who are involved in city planning and economic development, city governance, because they use foliage requirements a lot of times for that sort of economic development work. You know, I think someone testified that, you know, a big commercial property, for instance, may have worries that neighbors have over light pollution or noise pollution or a busy parking lot. And a lot of times a line of trees can stop that concern. So I think that communities are pretty concerned about this one. And I'm curious to see where it goes in the legislature this session.
We know you're staying on top of all this, long days and a few long nights ahead, right?
Oh, happy to do it. And happy to talk with you about it always.
Thank you, Emily Lawler from MLive, covering the lame duck session of the Michigan legislature. You're listening to Current State from WKAR. As you know, Michigan voted in a blue wave. The incoming governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and attorney general are all Democrats. But in this lame duck session, some say Republican lawmakers are trying to take away their power before they get sworn in. Morning Edition host Emily Fox and Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth talked about that a couple of days ago.
So the state legislature seems to be looking to reduce the power of the incoming Democratic Attorney General and Secretary of State. Walk us through how lawmakers are going about that, and let's start first with bills that could impact the Secretary of State.
Well, the Secretary of State bills, those are kind of the more direct sort of stripping of power from that office. And what Republican lawmakers, and it's pretty much all Republicans that are supporting these bills, what they're trying to do is they're trying to take away the oversight role of the Secretary of State when it comes to matters of campaign finance. Right now, the Secretary of State's staff is responsible for, you know, overseeing the campaign finance violations, and they want to give that power to this commission or board, and that would be made up of three Republicans and three Democrats. And what Republicans are saying is that, look, we are trying to make this a bipartisan effort, and that the Secretary of State is a partisan office, and this should, matters of campaign finance should go to this board that is made up of equal representation of Republicans and Democrats. Now, the problem with that is, according to campaign finance experts, is there's going to be inevitably, they say, gridlock on this board, that they're not going to be able to get anything done because you're going to have an equal number of Republicans and Democrats, and they're just not going to be able to agree on anything. And then, of course, Democrats are saying that, look, this is a power that has historically been in the office of the Secretary of State, and you're trying to take, and you're taking that away just as a Democrat is entering that office.
And then what about the bills that some say are undermining the incoming Democratic Attorney General?
So that one would allow for the House and the Senate to intervene in any court proceeding that they, quote, deem necessary. And this one is kind of interesting. So what Republicans are saying is, look, we are elected by the voters as well, and we want to have a voice in matters, and we want to be able to represent them. And it's interesting because at least one representative yesterday admitted that the timing of this is bad because there is now Democrats coming into this office. However, they said that this is something they've been considering for a while. But of course, Democrats are saying, look, we have an incoming Democrat coming into this office, and we are concerned that Republicans just want to essentially undermine her ability to choose which matters that the state gets involved in and which laws are sort of defended in court.
Shana Roth, Capitol correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. And here we are proud to announce a closer focus on covering government and politics here in the Capital Region and how lawmakers' decisions affect your life. Starting next week, you will hear the reporting of our new politics and government reporter, Abigail Sinsky, and she joins me in the studio right now. Welcome to WKAR, Abigail.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us where you joined us from and what was kind of your experience in covering politics?
So I'm coming from St. Louis Public Radio, where I served as the news intern and worked heavily with the politics team covering the 2018 midterms and the primary races there in Missouri. And before that, I worked at the Gazette in Colorado Springs, where I also covered Colorado politics.
What was one huge story you covered in St. Louis?
One of the biggest stories that I covered and one of my favorites was tracking all of the women candidates in Missouri's 2018 elections and seeing how they fared. And it was actually a record number of women that were running for office in Missouri. Now, a record number of women didn't exactly win, but it was a great story to follow and really interesting to track things when there was this national kind of re-upping of the Year of the Woman going on across the country.
And certainly we have a blue and pink wave here in Michigan that you'll be reporting on. What has caught your eye here so far?
I think, well, right now it's the lame duck session. It's kind of the like burning dumpster in the alley. It's hard to look away from for any politico, but I think Michigan is just a really interesting state because it is a state that regularly receives national attention in kind of four-year patterns. And so I think the most interesting thing about that is the fact that you can talk to the people and get to know the communities and what's going on outside of presidential election cycles and get to know a little bit more about what's driving the state and if it's red or blue or more purple, depending on who you're talking to.
And we'll be excited to have you on the campaign trails, you know, coming up for the 2020 presidential campaign. I know a lot of eyes will be on Michigan after, especially after what happened in 2016. Away from covering politics and civics, what do you think about Lansing? What do you like to do?
I feel like I have a lot to get to know about Lansing. It's great to have the capital city so proximate to East Lansing, with it kind of is more of a college town. Our capital in Missouri, Jefferson City, is far away, or not that far away, but it's far away from Columbia, where Mizzou is. So it's nice to be in a community that's dynamic because it's the state capital, but it's also dynamic because it's got MSU here. So there's all kinds of draws. So I'm interested to get to know the cultural elements of Lansing and experience what's going on here with the arts, and then also get to know what cool things there are to do around here outside.
And how can people follow you on Twitter or maybe even get in contact with you?
People can follow me on Twitter at Abigail Sensky. Last name is C-E-N-S-K-Y. And you can send me story tips or ideas at acensky at wkar.org.
Fantastic. Abigail Senske, we're going to be hearing a lot of her name a lot coming up. We are so thrilled to have you here at WKAR, and she'll jump right into the hot seat working with our Capitol correspondent, Shana Roth, to cover the rest of the lame duck session starting next week. Thank you for coming to WKAR. We're super excited and welcome.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
And good luck at the lame duck.
Thank you. I'll need it.
Up next, Flint Mayor Karen Weaver updates us on the pipe replacement program and what she expects from Michigan's new leaders in the new year.
We want to make sure that we're getting the lead out of Flint. And so we don't want to leave those pipes that are thought to be copper to copper unchecked.
Also, new guidelines proposed for classroom standards and school resource officers in Michigan. Our education reporter, Kevin Lavery, tells us what's ahead. You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick.
And I'm going to just start this press conference by saying thank God.
That was Mayor Karen Weaver last week when she announced her city's lead pipe replacement program is a year ahead of schedule. The replacement program is a response to the city's lead-tainted water crisis. Over the past 2 years, the city has checked more than 18,000 service lines connecting Flint homes to city water mains. Nearly 8,000 lead and galvanized pipes were replaced with copper. On Friday, Mayor Weaver talked with WKAR's Carell Vega about what's ahead in the new year, starting with the pipes.
We wanted to really get ahead of this because we've been waiting for such a long time. And so to get there, we had until the end of 2019. So to get there before the end of 2018 was a really, really good thing. And it was exciting, and it was a great announcement for the city of Flint. And so we've continued. We didn't stop. And so we're still addressing those other pipes that we talked about, because one thing we want to do is be sure that we have addressed this issue across the city.
Now that you're ahead of schedule, is there a new timeline that the city's following for the expected completion of this project?
Well, you know what? We're looking to be finished by the end of July of 2019, which would still make us ahead of schedule because, like I said, we have until the end of December of 2019, or you could say the first of 2020. So we will still be ahead of schedule, and that's what we want to have happen.
Can residents drink the tap water yet?
No, I'm not. I am not signing off on that because one thing, we've talked with the EPA and nothing has changed as far as what they've recommended when you have this amount of construction going on is to stay on bottled and filtered water. And so that's the recommendation. And even once we have all of the pipes replaced, I want to meet with the medical community and see what is their time frame as far as testing and how much testing do they want to see attain certain results before they say, okay, let's give the all clear.
Mayor Weaver, a judge has now ruled that Michigan's chief medical executive, Eden Wells, will head to trial on manslaughter charges in relation to the Flint water crisis. Do you have any comments on this recent development?
Really, my comment remains the same. We've been waiting for accountability in the city of Flint, and we know what happened here was criminal. So we've been looking for accountability ever since this water crisis started. So, one thing I've learned to do is stay in my lane and let the legal process play itself out. But we're going to see. We're going to see what happens. But we know that people should be held accountable because we had loss of life here in the city of Flint. And that should not go unaccountable.
How would you respond to criticism from some groups such as the Natural Resources Defense Council that the city has prioritized digging holes around the city as opposed to actually replacing the pipes?
Well, if you don't dig a hole, you can't replace a pipe, number one. You have to dig the hole to see what's in there, and we did prioritize. So, we have a difference of opinion with them. Like I said, I mean, if you don't dig, how can you replace? So when you open it up and you find out it's copper to copper, we're supposed to leave it in place. And that's what we've done. So, I'm going to stay focused on what it is we're trying to do, and that's get all of the lead out of the city of Flint. And for someone to say we haven't prioritized, I think that's incorrect information. I think that's and I think it's a shame, because we ought to be celebrating what has happened in the city of Flint, that we have been ahead of schedule and we've gotten so much done and so much accomplished, and we'll be getting those other pipes done. Or maybe I shouldn't even say that. I should say we'll be excavating, and those that are lead or galvanized, we will replace, and we will get that done before we were supposed to get this 18,000 done. So some people don't like good news, but it's good news for the people of Flint, and I'm going to stay focused on what it is I'm supposed to do.
We're speaking with Flint Mayor Karen Weaver about the announcement this week that the city is a year ahead of schedule in its effort to replace lead pipes around the city. Mayor Weaver, as the lame duck session continues at the Capitol, do you see anything being done for Flint?
You know what? It almost reminds me of what happened in Flint, to be perfectly honest. It looks like they've put in a bigger RTAB at the state level. And that's what the legislature is acting like the RTAB that was set aside in Flint, where they're taking away executive power and doing what they want to do. They've taken away the voice of the people. And I'm going to tell you, I think it's really discouraging, because you talk to so many people about the importance of their vote. And when people say, okay, I'm going to come and vote, and then it's like their voice has been taken, because what you've put in place doesn't matter, and the people that you've put in place to lead the vision that they've talked about doesn't matter. And I think it's sad, but it's what we've experienced right here in the city of Flint with emergency managers and having an RTAB and having our voice taken. People voted for, you know, we thought it was a democracy, and you find out it's not.
Do you have an outgoing message for Governor Rick Snyder?
Do I have an outgoing message for for the governor? I guess goodbye.
And what's your biggest hope for Gretchen Whitmer and the incoming Democrats?
You know what? I hope that things stay in place. They were voted to be the voice of the people. The people put them in place, and we put them in place for a reason. We knew we needed to have a friend at the state level. We knew that Flint had been done wrong, and we had not been made whole. And so we've continued to talk about the needs of Flint, and really the needs across this state. So I'm excited about the new administration. I'm looking forward to working with them. But I think what is happening to them is a tragedy, and it just doesn't make any sense.
We've been speaking with Flint Mayor Karen Weaver about the city's announcement this week that they're a year ahead of schedule in replacing lead pipes around the city. Mayor Weaver, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Okay, thank you.
For WKAR, I'm Karel Vega.
This is Current State from WKAR. From elementary school standards to school resource officers to equipment in the hands of every Lansing kindergartner, there are some exciting changes on tap for local schools. So we asked WKAR education reporter Kevin Lavery to bring us up to speed.
After months of work, the Michigan School Safety Task Force has presented a set of recommendations to Governor Rick Snyder. In April, the governor directed the group to review and modify best practices that school districts can use to protect their students and staff. One goal of the task force is to create a standard curriculum for training school resource officers. I visited a Lansing high school to learn more about the unique role of the SRO. From the moment you see him, Dale Person makes an impression. Well over 6 feet tall, with a ready smile, he strides through Everett High School with an easy rapport toward everyone he meets.
What's up, fellas? You guys all right?
His disarming demeanor makes you forget he's armed, and that's the point.
What's going on?
Lansing Police Officer Dale Person wants you to see him as exactly that, a person. He wears khakis and a navy blue polo. The kids don't see his tin badge. For a reason.
And a lot of times, them seeing hard blue, they think about maybe some of the negative interactions that they have had on the road or outside in the public or whatever. And so now we wear, you know, the polo shirt and the soft pants or whatever. So it'll make them think that we're more approachable.
To call Dale Person approachable is an understatement. When we sit down in his office to talk, it's not long before someone comes knocking. By now, this is all routine.
How's it going? Yeah, what do you ask me every day?
Sticker.
He wants a police sticker. So this
you
is just
them?
The...
Yes, oh my God.
Hopefully I have one.
I want a sticker.
The number one goal of an SRO is to bridge the gap between law enforcement and youth.
That's Mo Kennedy. He's the executive director of NASRO, the National Association of School Resource Officers. The organization trains veteran police to be that liaison. It's not a job for everyone, but Kennedy says an SRO uses a technique every good patrol officer knows well.
Officers on the street use a lot of informal counseling in dealing with situations, which includes de-escalating tense situations.
In high school, tension can arise anywhere, whether it's in class or on the court. Dale Person knows how to cool down athletes, too. Before he was an SRO, Person coached Everett football for a decade.
Isn't the object to put the ball in the basket?
Person uses those informal counseling skills every day. He says students often confide in him about problems they don't know how to handle at home.
Believe it or not, they will talk to you and tell you exactly what it is that, you know, that they're dealing with. So a lot of times I'm a listening ear, but then I'll flip it around and say, okay, from a parent's perspective, this is what they're seeing. And a lot of times when you do that and you come at them, you know, from that perspective, they'll say, okay, I got it.
Person also spends some of his time in the classroom, often as a guest speaker. But an SRO, of course, is more than a mentor or a lecturer. Schools also need a cop. That's particularly vital in a life-threatening situation like a mass shooting. There have been at least 65 gun-related incidents in schools in America since the start of 2018.
A school resource officer is uniquely situated in that they are probably there alone in the beginning of that event.
Tim Burgoyes is the executive director of MCOLS, the Michigan Commission on Law Enforcement Standards. He led the state task force subcommittee on school resource officers.
And that is a different response than coming from a patrol situation where you may be responding with multiple other officers.
After a gunman killed 17 people at a high school in Parkland, Florida last February, the SRO on duty was widely criticized for not entering the building. Officer Scott Peterson claimed he had no real-time information to determine where the shots were coming from. Peterson resigned shortly after the incident. Back at Everett High School, Officer Dale Person thinks about that eventuality a lot.
I would want to be able to be there for them in that type of situation, no matter what, because the feeling of those kids could be the same feeling that my child has, and I would want them to know that there's somebody that's out there willing to protect them and render aid if it's needed. So that's the way I look at doing my job.
Preparing for the day every officer prays will never come is part of a school resource officer's training. Now, with recommendations in hand, Michigan officials can begin to create a standard curriculum for every SRO in the state. In his final days in office, Governor Rick Snyder will review the findings of the Michigan School Safety Task Force. But ultimately, it will be up to his successor, Governor-elect Gretchen Whitmer, to carry them out. In November, the Michigan State Board of Education approved a new set of standards for preparing young teachers to work in the elementary grades. I spoke with Dr. Nell Duke, a professor of education at the University of Michigan. She was on the team that helped develop the standards, and Duke told me the previous standards were outdated and not rigorous enough to meet today's academic demands.
Michigan is not where we want it to be in terms of literacy achievement, and so we're looking for all different ways to try to address that issue, and one of the ways we can address it is by trying to have our teachers as well prepared as possible to teach reading and other literacy skills. A second reason is we have adjusted our grade certification bands in Michigan. Our previous band was kindergarten through 8 self-contained. That's a pretty wide range. You could probably think about how different it is to teach a kindergartner in literacy than it is to teach a self-contained classroom of eighth graders in literacy. So the state revised the grade bands so that there's a band that's specifically pre-kindergarten to grade 3, as well as a band that's grade 3 to 6.
So this really reflects cognitive differences between pre-K through third grade years and fourth grade through 6th.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that when most people hear the term literacy, what probably comes to mind immediately is simply the ability to read. But looking at this definition that's in these standards, it says literacy includes reading, writing, speaking, listening, viewing, and visually representing. I'm interested in learning what visual representation means as it relates to literacy.
Sure. So the ability to, for example, put together a PowerPoint presentation that would include written words, certainly, but might also include graphs and diagrams and visuals that will draw the audience's attention, that might include audio clips or short video clips embedded, that would be part of literacy, to be able to put those all together to communicate meaning.
Are we asking kindergarten students or first grade students to be able to have those skills?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, definitely we put this on a developmental continuum, and we aren't expecting kindergartners to, on their own, you know, create a PowerPoint presentation like an adult might give to his or her boss. But we know we need to lay the groundwork for that very early.
We've done a lot of coverage here on this station, Dr. Duke, on the third grade law, which, of course, was passed a couple of years ago, but it really is fully implemented next school year, 2019. And we've discussed the repercussions of being able to be proficient on the M-STEP. I'm wondering if these proposed standards were set in motion before that even happened, before that law was passed, if this is a proactive or a reactive measure to that law.
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to your question. I'm not sure when this process was first conceptualized. I can tell you that it's pretty customary for states to revise their standards pretty regularly every decade or so. But I will say that these standards make an important contribution to all the efforts that are going on in the state to try to improve the literacy of Michigan students.
If I were the parent of an elementary student, what would I need to be aware of in terms of helping my child become 21st century literate in ways in which, you know, literacy was not expected of me during my era when I was that age?
Families might want to be aware of a concept we call co-viewing, which is the idea that as much as possible, rather than just putting our child in front of the TV or any type of digital, you know, device while we're off doing something else, that as much as possible, we want to be right alongside that child so that we can talk about what we're seeing, we can make meaning together, we can help them understand. I'm a busy working mom, and I totally appreciate that there are times when we can't be right by our child's side, but as much as possible, that's something to strive for.
Dr. Nell Duke is a professor of education at the University of Michigan and is part of the team that is working on the proposed standards for the preparation of teachers in lower and upper elementary, which the Michigan State Board of Education is expected to approve today. Dr. Duke, thank you again for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
They're called digital natives. From video games to smartphones, most American children have some proficiency with technology. In Lansing, a unique learning project is helping some of the city's youngest students build their digital skills. They're using Android tablets provided by WKAR to learn educational concepts based on public television programming. Researchers at Michigan State University are tracking the students' math skills, and soon they'll add reading lessons. When LaDonna Mask is around Lansing's youngest learners, the veteran principal's eyes light up, and the once-upon-a-time kindergarten teacher comes through.
You are great kindergartners!
Mask was the principal here at Kendon Elementary in Lansing for more than 4 years. These days, she's on special assignment for the district. That means she helps bridge the digital divide by putting educational tools into the hands of students.
Alyssa!
On this day, LaDonna Mask is handing out touchscreens styled in vibrant hues of green and blue.
It was so amazing for me to see them when they opened those boxes. They were able to do things that us adults couldn't even imagine.
This is fun.
These kindergartners are using the PBS Playtime Pad. It's an Android tablet preloaded with math games, music, videos, and other PBS-themed content.
PBS Kids!
PBS first marketed the device in 2016. Last year, WKAR distributed more than 1,000 Playtime Pads to Lansing kindergartners. This school year, that number rose to 1,200. Access to online instruction is a priority in urban schools, where the divide between the digital haves and have-nots can be significant.
There's a need for great educational resources here in our community, and incorporating a technology device like the PBS Kids Playtime Pad can help facilitate that.
Julie Soche is the Content and Community Engagement Manager at WKAR. This station isn't the only PBS affiliate in the country sending tablets to schools. But Soche says WKAR may be the only one that's studying how the kids are actually using them.
As far as we know, this research component and partnership is the first of its kind in the nation.
At Michigan State University, researchers track each tablet by number. The children themselves remain anonymous. Dr. Amy Parks is an associate professor of elementary education at MSU. She's not monitoring any particular student's activity. Instead, she's looking for patterns to see what types of apps entire classrooms or even schools are using and how often. Park says the results of the first year weren't quite what she expected.
When we went into the data and we looked at how often the math games were used, we found that for most kids, it averaged less than 13 minutes a week. So that was considerably less than the 15 minutes three times a week that we had asked teachers to use them for.
Park says this does not mean the tablets were only used for 13 minutes in a week. The students were given free rein over which games they wanted to play, and Park says they often opted not to play the targeted math games. This year, she says, there's more direct supervision in the classroom. Parks notes there were some positive outcomes, too. She says some teachers created innovative tablet-based lessons.
When they were studying shapes, they took the camera on the tablet and they went around and had kids take pictures of circles in the room or squares in the room. There was an art game on there where kids could draw, and they used it in literacy lessons to have kids write letters or write words.
And that's the next step. This year, the Lansing School District is testing an app called iRead. It's compatible with the new core literacy curriculum the district adopted this year. The iRead project will be rolled out at Riddle Elementary and Dwight Rich School of the Arts in Lansing.
I like the top.
LaDonna Mask, the former Kendon principal, is happy that more students will add the PBS Playtime pads to their daily learning.
To be able to have this technology that they can use on a daily basis is just phenomenal. Because as we know, our children now are growing up in a technology age, so they're going to really need to have this.
Officials hope the iRead program will strengthen Lansing's already keen focus on literacy. It comes at a time when teachers all over the state are doing everything they can to help their students become strong readers. Under the law, next year's third-grade students who fail to score proficiently on the English Language Arts section of the MSTEP test will be held back in the 2020 school year. In Lansing, I'm Kevin Lavery for WKAR News.
Smoking was on the decline until e-cigarettes debuted. Coming up, the trends and the health concerns. Plus, a listen to our new classical music release of the month. You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Thank you for listening to Current State from WKAR. Smoking is a lot different these days. It's been on the decline due to restrictions at work and in bars and restaurants. But one area is growing fast: teenagers who use e-cigarettes. Araceli Gomez Adana, from our reporting partner, Side Effects Public Media, tells us about the trend and the health concerns.
In the same way Facebook became a verb, like Facebook me, the electronic cigarette Juul created a new verb, juuling. It's a reference to the San Francisco company that dominates the e-cigarette market. They're small and sleek and easy to hide.
There's jokes. People call bathrooms Juul rooms, especially in high school. It's just easy. It's easy to conceal.
That's Devin Rohrer, an 18-year-old college freshman. I caught up with him at a cafeteria at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He tried a Juul for the first time when he was a junior in high school. A classmate offered it to him at a party. He says they're common among people his age.
I've never seen an adult Juul my entire life. Never, ever seen an adult with a Juul. Only children.
The head of the Food and Drug Administration calls the use of addictive electronic cigarettes among youth an epidemic. And according to this year's National Youth Tobacco Survey, 3.6 million teens are using e-cigarettes. That's up 78% from last year. In Indiana, the overall smoking rate has dropped significantly since 2011, but Miranda Spitznuggle, director of the state's Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Programs, says there's a big exception.
Generally, that has been trending down, except for this one particular classification of products among young people, which is e-cigarettes.
Companies like Juul that sell electronic cigarettes promote their products as a healthier, safer alternative to cigarettes. In a statement posted on its website, Juul CEO Kevin Burns wrote, "We don't want anyone who doesn't smoke or already uses nicotine to use Juul products. We certainly don't want youth using the product, and they are easy to use." The Juul device fits in your hand. Click in a pod, think flavors like mango, mint, or cucumber, and all you have to do is inhale. There's minimal smoke or vapor, and it's gone within seconds. What your body gets is a jolt of nicotine. One pod has as much nicotine as a pack of traditional cigarettes. That's what worries public health experts.
The young brain is much more likely to get hooked and then to have problems later.
Dr. Leslie Holvershorn is an associate professor of psychiatry at Indiana University School of Medicine. She says early exposure to any addictive substance can lead to future substance abuse disorders. The federal government also says nicotine exposure during adolescence may harm brain development. Still, Holvershorn says she doesn't have any teen patients looking for treatment to stop using e-cigarettes.
Like, I think people just think if you just chew some gum or just really try to quit, you can do it. And I mean, it's not to say you can't do it, it's just odds are kind of stacked against you. It's hard to do.
On its packaging and ads, Juul warns the product contains nicotine, and nicotine is an addictive substance. The company also said recently that it is taking flavored pods out of convenience stores and only selling them at vape shops or tobacco stores. The FDA is pushing for more. In late November, it proposed regulations to crack down on flavored electronic nicotine delivery systems and making it harder for teens to buy them online. But some students say Juuls are still readily available in high school. I spoke to two seniors. They only gave me their first names, Noah and John, at an Indianapolis mall.
I've been off with it. Like, I've never done it, and I've straight up just been, like, off with to do it.
Yeah, like, it's ridiculous how easy it is to get. Like, even if you're underage, like, it's ridiculously easy.
As for Devin Rohr, the IUPUI freshman, he was turned off by Juul's nicotine levels.
And I sold Juul's, and I thought, oh, it's just another, like, tiny, like, low nicotine vape. And then I heard my friend tell me, oh, it has 50 milligrams in it. And, like, that's a little too much.
He replaced his Juul with another device and says it has low nicotine, if at all. I'm Araceli Gomez-Aldana for Side Effects Public Media.
We're not the only Midwestern state seeing lame duck proposals and protests. In Wisconsin, GOP lawmakers have voted for new limits on the governor's power. Voters last month elected Democrat Tony Evers to that job over incumbent Republican Scott Walker. Republicans say they're trying to protect the laws they've enacted in their 8 years of control, but Democrats see it as a power grab. Laurel White of Wisconsin Public Radio explains.
Plans to significantly rein in the power of Democratic Governor-elect Tony Evers passed the Wisconsin State Senate in the wee hours of Wednesday morning, when hardly any members of the public were there to see it. Just a couple of hours later, they passed the state assembly.
You won't even do this in the daylight. You won't even do this in the daylight. People are sleeping.
That was Democratic State Representative Chris Taylor. Taylor and other Democrats argued the bills are an abuse of power by the legislature's Republican majority. Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz said Republicans are trying to override the will of the people after losing the governor's office in November.
Give me a break. The disrespect you've shown to this institution, to the fundamental framework of democracy, is appalling. It's embarrassing, and we're a national disgrace right now.
Many of the measures are aimed at keeping Governor-elect Evers from rolling back GOP-backed laws passed under Governor Scott Walker. That includes Wisconsin's voter ID law. During debate, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said that law deserves protection and that Evers shouldn't be able to undo it with the stroke of a pen.
Now, I know you don't like voter ID, but voter ID was passed by the legislature. It was enacted by the governor.
Also protected under the proposals are Wisconsin's work requirements for public benefits like food stamps, as well as an economic development agency created under the Walker administration. Democratic Governor-elect Evers campaigned on abolishing that agency. In recent days, his response to the GOP proposals has been measured. In a statement released after the vote, Evers said he hopes Republicans will be more collaborative after he takes office. But he did admonish lawmakers, saying Wisconsin values of decency, kindness, and finding common ground were pushed aside by their votes. Some in Wisconsin are already preparing for conflict.
There will be political and legal consequences over the actions of the Wisconsin legislative Republicans.
Annalise Eicher is the program director for liberal advocacy group One Wisconsin Institute, which successfully sued the state 2 years ago over voting restrictions.
We were going to be reviewing these changes, whether or not they're signed by Governor Walker, section by section, line by line, word by word, to put together the best case moving forward.
Court challenges against power limits like these aren't unprecedented. Similar laws have been defeated in North Carolina. Evers is scheduled to take office in January. When he does, he'll face GOP majorities in the state assembly and Senate. But he'll also wield one of the most powerful veto pens in the country. For NPR News, I'm Laurel White in Madison.
Time to get back into the sounds of the season. WKAR 90.5 Classical's December new release of the month focuses on the holiday spirit. WKAR station manager Peter Worf explains.
It always begins with a single voice. The young soprano, chosen just before the performance, opens the annual Christmas Eve Day concert from King's College, Cambridge, the Nine Lessons and Carol service. "100 Years of Nine Lessons and Carols" is the newest from BBC recordings, and WKAR 90.5 Classical's new release of the month for December. The choir of King's College compiles recordings of broadcast performances going back 60 years in a tradition that began a century ago with Dean Eric Milner White. Nine Lessons and Carols follows a traditional roadmap every year, always opening with "Once in Royal David City," this from last year's service, and always concluding with Sussex Carol, "I Saw Three Ships," "The Holly and the Ivy" are among the favorites that frequent the Nine Lessons playlist. Every Christmas, Cambridge commissions a new work. Cambridge native Judith Weir's "O Mercy Divine" will premiere this December 24th. A master of the Queen's music, Weir's "Illuminate Jerusalem" was showcased in 1985's Lessons and Carols. Years of Nine Lessons and Carols, with highlights from the choir of King's College, Cambridge, David Wilcox, Philip Ledger, and Stephen Cleobury, is WKAR 90.5 Classical's December new release of the month. I'm Peter Worf.
And on that musical note, we will thank you for listening. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. For the entire WKAR News team, have a great weekend. We'll connect with you again soon.